All right. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the Freedom Fiends. This is Garrett Fox, orbiting high above the planet Earth from Space Worm 1, broadcasting to you. Very excited to be here. You may have noticed that I am not Michael Dean. unfortunately, we will not be joined by him tonight. He has got a very important thing going on in Las Vegas right now, known as him and DJ are out at Vegas for the International Cat Ranchers Association Convention, or ICRAC for short. So that should be an interesting event out there. I can't wait to hear some stories about that, and we will hear about that tomorrow when he returns to the Freedom Fiends. And tonight, I am joined by a new good friend of mine, Randy England. How are you doing tonight, Randy?
I am fine. Good evening, Garrett. I'm glad to be here. I'm sorry I can't be with Michael in Las Vegas, but this is the next best thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm really glad that we were able to get together for this show tonight, because you're one of the fellow Freedom Fiends that I didn't get a chance to meet. You were not in attendance for Porkfest this year, huh?
Unfortunately, that's true. And now I can't go to Las Vegas. I don't have a cat.
Really? You don't have a cat? That's a surprising turn of events for a fellow fiend.
I've had cats. I just don't happen to have a cat right now.
Yeah, I had to give my kitty the boot tonight. I was going to have her hanging out with us tonight for the show, but I was just worried that she might be making a little too much ruckus. We actually had to take her to get her rabies shot yesterday, and it was very hard to watch her get stabbed with the needle. But she did really, really good, and we got to see a whole bunch of other cats and dogs as we were waiting in line to go through for our little. It was basically a freebie day, or a very discounted day to go get a rabies shot. So a $6 rabies shot was a lot nicer than the vet visit where you have to spend a significant more amount of money. But she's doing good. She's nice and rested up. She bounced right back from it and is owning the apartment like nothing ever happened. So
I came out from behind the sofa.
Yes, exactly. And now she's on top of the sofa, on top of the table, and all over the place. I think we need to get her one of those trees so that she has something to climb on. More like a cat's natural environment. And so I guess, like I was saying, this is Garrett Fox, also known as the Funky Fox. And I'm actually thinking about changing that name. I might have to do a certain wrestling match and see if I can win that in order to get it changed to the Freedom Fox. I think that sounds a little bit better than the Funky Fox. I don't know. And so you're the Wampus Cat, right?
That's correct. Yes.
I was actually listening to a previous episode where you guys were discussing that, and I couldn't help but get a grin on my face thinking about it, because that was what the Wampus Cat was, kind of an urban legend for the Boy Scouts. Was it
when I was in the Boy Scouts? And I think that the Wampus Cat has a fairly wide spread that it stalks over, but I was from southern Illinois, and when I was in the Boy Scouts, the Wampus Cat was known to, well, take several Boy Scouts every year at camp, and was always talked about around the campfire.
So I guess that was an interesting way for the scoutmasters and other chaperones to keep you guys from wandering off in the middle of the night and maybe sticking to the group, maybe.
It didn't work, but.
Well, yeah, because now you wanted to go out looking for these Wampus Cats, huh?
We did go out. Fortunately, we never found one. But yeah. I've never met anyone who survived that encounter, so it was just as well.
Yeah, and it was an interesting tidbit about it, how it made you guys. You guys were setting up your tents from, was it east to west? Because
well, Yeah, everybody knows that a wampus cat hunts on a north-south line, and we were always taught that you set up your tents on an east-west line because wampus cats, oh, another thing is that they, when they hunt, they walk backwards. And you just would feel really silly, and you would be in big trouble if a wampus cat backed into your tent some night. So you always set up in the one direction. That way they would never accidentally just stumble into your tent. And we followed that faithfully and see, the whole time I was a Boy Scout anyway.
That makes me wonder if there's any significance to setting up your tent from east to west. Like, I was wondering if that had anything to do with the sunrise and sunset, or if that was just the way the whole story worked.
You know, for me, it was always because of the wampus cat. And that was the kind of wampus cat that we had where I was from. I heard that there were other wampus cats. There's hillside wampus cats, which... The legs on one side of their body are longer than the other, and so the only way they could walk upright was to walk on hillsides, you know, with the shorter leg higher up. And, you know, they could even kind of get stuck on a hill that was round because all they could do is go around in a circle. They couldn't go up or down because their legs didn't work. And
you know, I was actually a Boy Scout for a little while. It was a fun time. I think I was the only quote unquote anarchist in my troop though. So I guess this was such a long time ago that I really didn't even know what I was talking about at the time. I think it was more or less I just liked the symbol and the anti-authoritarian part of everything. But I really, really wanted to get together with other kids my age and learn some of these important survival skills and go camping and go on skiing trips and all that stuff.
Tie knots, play with knives.
I was just getting ready to say, I got one merit badge. Is that what they were called, the merit badge? Yeah,
they had merit badges. But are you talking about the where you had, I think they had a thing called a totem chip you had to get before you were allowed to carry a knife. You had to show that you weren't a complete idiot before they allowed you to carry one to camp.
You know, I might not have had to deal with that. I remember I always had my little Swiss Army pocket knife with me, and then I quickly traded that in for some lockable blades just because those things are notorious for slipping.
Yeah, and I think that I don't remember what if this qualification on a knife, you know, was just for a big knife that you would wear on your belt or if it applied to a little pocket knife. It's been a long time since I was a Boy Scout.
Yeah, the only merit badge I ever got was my knot tying merit badge. And I think that was just kind of the trial run. Like, if you can handle tying this, you know, handful of different knots, then we're going to go ahead and give you a badge so you can get started on that. But I'm currently going to be, I'm really excited to see what comes out of our buddy Davi Barker's badge. What were they calling them? The freedom badge, the porcupine badges.
Have you seen badges?
Well, yeah, he's got his shiny badges, and then they have the sort of the merit badge thing going on for porcupines. I've seen a whole bunch of graphics on him. That guy Davi, he's constantly bringing out really cool graphics and neat ideas and stuff. So,
but I think I've looked those up on the website. Yeah, some of those are really good looking too.
Yeah, yeah. And I got one of my police shield shiny badges before. I got that, I believe, last year at Porkfest. And I can't believe it. I forgot to bring it this year to Porkfest. I saw everybody else running around with their shiny badges, and I didn't get to don mine upon my breast or anything. But
you don't even want to mention that you have one at home. You just feel like an idiot because you're not wearing it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And believe it or not, I saw a tattoo come out of that. I thought that was a really interesting thing. Somebody had gotten that image tattooed on their shoulder, I believe it was. And it was really well done, too. I was excited to see that.
Yeah. I was going to say it would depend on whether it was well done or not.
Yeah, it looked really good. It had, you know, just a couple of different colors to it. So I'm not entirely sure who did the artwork, but I'm sure that's got to be very flattering to, you know, see your own artwork being tattooed on somebody else.
It was a good thing it was there. I wonder what happens to you if you have something copyrighted on you. I mean, something tattooed that's copyrighted. I wonder if anyone's ever gotten sued for that or something.
Ooh, you know, that is very interesting. I never really thought about that.
You know, like Popeye or something.
And you mentioned that, and I'm sure there's a ton of people out there with Popeye tattoos, and I guess you wouldn't really want to get too many corporate logos on there. But now that I think about it, I've seen people with the Windows logo tattooed onto them. So I would imagine. Well, you're not making any money off of it. It's not like you're reselling it. So maybe it would be the tattoo artist that would get in trouble for that. But
well, I think you would be accomplices in that act of piracy. And if you didn't make any money off of it, I guess they would say that, yeah, but you didn't pay us anything, though. So you're still way ahead.
Yeah. And so I guess you... could you tell me a little bit about your professional background? I know were you a prosecutor?
Well, I was. Right now, ever since I quit being a prosecutor, I'm a criminal defense attorney.
Okay,
and that's just simply because that's the only way that you can be a lawyer and be against the state on every single case.
Okay.
And so I can live with that, and that's what I do. But for 14 years, I was a prosecutor and attorney. I was a state prosecutor here in Missouri. And, that's really where I finally figured out that the victimless crime laws and that just were not doing any good, and we were really wasting our time, and we weren't helping anybody. And it's sort of odd that, you know, you would come to that belief, but I've been very libertarian all of my life, you know, when it came to government, and just hated their wars and mostly hated everything that they did in that. But for a long time, I thought that the drug war was useful and doing some good.
Yeah, sure.
And yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we get into that a little bit more when we come back on the other side of this trip to the market, because I'd love to ask you some questions about, what you can do is...
Let's do it.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio worms.
Mm-hmm. All righty. Here we are. We're back. Doing the Freedom Fiends, doing that freedom thing. This is Garrett Fox, the Funky Fox, joined by Randy England, the Wampus Cat. And Randy, since you have a nice legal background, I feel like you may or may not have experienced this. Well, jury nullification. I feel like I need to hear your description of this. I feel like I have a pretty good idea of what it is. I mean, I'll tell you, as far as I understand how it goes, is basically a jury in a trial can basically decide to essentially throw out a case if they don't feel that the, whoever's being charged with a certain crime, whether or not it was actually whether or not there was a victim. This is why I wanted to get your rendition of it.
Sure. I've had juries nullify my behind around the courtroom on several occasions, and as a prosecutor, it isn't a pleasant experience. juries, before the, when the evidence is finished in a case, you know, the judge sits down, the judge reads a jury instructions to the jury, and the main instruction that the judge reads to you, say you had a DWI case,
okay,
they would say to the juror, the judge would say to the jury, as well, if you find and believe from the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, that first of all, like on March 20th, 2014, on Highway 54 in Cole County in the state of Missouri, that's where I live,
right,
that the defendant operated a motor vehicle, and second of all, that he did so while intoxicated, then you will find the defendant guilty of driving while intoxicated. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's not you may find him guilty. You will find him guilty. And the whole thing, you know, sounds super mechanical, like you just say, okay, we have to decide, was he intoxicated and was he driving? Because if that's it, he's automatically guilty. But, I mean, I found out that it doesn't really work that way. And like I said, I had some times when it happened. I know one time I had a felony jury trial. And I have a felony jury trial means the defendant has already been convicted a couple times at least already for it to be a felony, at least in this state. And the defendant in my case, I mean, he had been, I mean, he was sloppy, stinking, really, really drunk.
Okay.
And his lawyer would have been the only person in that town who would dispute that with a straight face. But the jury came back after those instructions with a not guilty verdict. And several of the jurors afterward, they actually sought me out as the prosecutor. And they wanted it. They told me, they were consoling me. They told me, said, don't feel bad. You know, he said, you did a good job. Don't worry. But there was no way we were going to find that nice boy guilty of a felony, they said.
Okay. And see, that's an interesting example because, I mean, in that case, if the guy was as filthy, stinking drunk as you say he was, there potentially could have been bodily harm to somebody else. That's obviously one of those sticky situations where...
Well, they just didn't like it.
Right.
Let me give you a better example, a kind of one that kind of brings in the community standards in that one. That one, they just really liked the defendant, and they just refused to do it, even though the evidence was rock solid. And another fellow, he was acquitted after, I proved this guy's guilty. He belonged beyond all possible doubt that he illegally possessed a concealed weapon.
Okay.
Which was a knife that he kept under the driver's seat of his car.
Which I'm sure plenty of people do, though. You know, it's
oh, you bet.
Yeah.
Well, I knew that. As a matter of fact, I ended up trying the case kind of because I had to. But also, I hadn't done one like that, so I didn't really know how it would come out. And they acquitted this guy, and I spoke with some of the jurors afterwards, and they just said they disagreed with the law. They said, there's no way, you know, we're not going to convict a guy for doing what everybody has a right to do, they said.
Yeah, God forbid somebody possesses something that enables them to defend themselves or cut open a box when they need to.
Yeah, and I couldn't disagree with them. I mean, I still think anyone has. Now, it's... The law has changed in Missouri now, and anyone is allowed to say keep a handgun in their car, and that's what the law should be. But that was an example of the jury just saying, "We don't care for your law. We don't care what you want, you know. And you know, if you're doing your job, fine. But we won't enforce it."
All right.
So
well,
there you go.
I'll tell you what. I want to pick your brain a little bit more on this jury nullification stuff, and maybe we can mention FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, and talk a little bit about what they do.
Sure.
All right. More when we come back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. I just got official word that the name has been changed from the Funky Fox to the Freedom Fox, and I'm glad to hear that I've gotten the official approval on that name change there. I didn't even have to go through any wrestling matches to defend my name. And we're going to go with that. This is Garrett Fox, the Freedom Fox, here with Randy England, the Wampus Cat. And during the break, I got an anonymous tip, Randy. I believe you did as well. Michael Dean and DJ they've done the old switcheroo-y, and instead of attending the International Cat Ranchers Association Convention, or ICRAC for short, in Las Vegas, they've decided to hang out in the windowless bunker and binge watch back-to-back episodes of CSI. So it's good to know you're comfortable, Michael, and we'll definitely be back in time for the show tomorrow. So that's good news there. And so, Randy, before we went into the during the last segment, we got a little bit into jury nullification, and you've had some interesting run-ins, I guess, on the latter side of jury nullification. I know you wanted to bring up a little bit more of that. So what do you got for us there?
Well, besides being schooled on jury nullifications, there is sort of, the legal basis for it is sort of interesting. I mean, jury nullification basically means that a jury can acquit a defendant if they don't like what the law is. The judge reads them, what the law is and says, if you find this fact and this fact true, you will find him guilty. But in fact, when a jury is in a nullifying mood, they judge the facts and they judge the law. And if they don't think either one of those comes up to snuff, they're not going to convict somebody. And the way that they can get away with giving a not guilty verdict when the facts clearly show that the defendant really did do exactly what they've been accused of doing starts mainly with the Fifth Amendment, to the Constitution, which is the prohibition against double jeopardy. And the defendant, once the defendant's acquitted, they cannot be tried a second time.
Right. Okay. I feel like I've seen that in certain situations where they had to almost come up with some other way of charging this person, like kind of get them on some other technicality or try them for a different reason. Is that
some totally different charge is what it would have to be? The problem is the state, because of the double jeopardy prohibition against a second trial once you're acquitted, the state can't appeal a guilty verdict. If they get a bad ruling during the trial from a judge and say some evidence comes in that shouldn't come in and would never come in if the judge had gotten it right, and that causes the defendant to be acquitted, tough luck, Mr. Prosecutor. It's over. It's gone. Next case. I mean, okay. That's just the way it goes. And prosecutors, just learn to live with that, and you just know you got to get it right the first time or there will not be a second one. And that's the way, that's the mindset, you get into when you're a prosecutor. Now, you got the fact, okay, that not guilty verdicts, they're binding, they're unappealable. And there's another factor in there that's kind of important, and that's that a juror cannot be punished for rendering a not guilty verdict.
No matter what the judge says or tells you to say, you cannot be punished for that. Is that?
No matter how obvious it is that defendant did exactly what he was accused of doing and the jury just defied the judge's instructions and acquitted anyway, there's nothing the judge can do about it. I mean, unless you commit, a crime like taking a bribe, you're untouchable as a juror.
And I guess this is something that your average juror, the average American citizen, if you will, who gets that little piece of paper in the mail that says you have to show up for jury duty, probably is not aware of. Am I right? Like, this kind of gives them...
Well, even if they had some idea of it when they went into the courtroom, you go in there, you have to... swear an oath, that you will rightly judge, the law and the facts in the case. And by the time you get done, you're pretty well convinced that you have to do this. You have no choice. You can't go anywhere else with it, and you just can't do it. Now, the problem and the whole thing with the jury nullification organizations and the movement for jury nullification is that it's completely legal that a jury does this. I mean, in my state, we have a case, I think it's 30 years old or more, you know, that says that the courts recognize that juries do nullify from time to time, but they say the practice isn't encouraged. And when they say it isn't encouraged, they mean we instruct the jury that they must not do it.
Okay.
And we do not allow anyone in the courtroom to mention it.
Now, let me ask you this. In a situation where the jury does nullify something, does it have to be unanimous across the entire jury? Or, like, how does that part work?
Well, no. Either a guilty verdict or a not guilty verdict must be unanimous.
Okay.
But there are plenty of cases where you have nullification causing a mistrial or what they call a hung jury, where they cannot reach a unanimous verdict, so it's 6-6 or it's 11-1 or whatever the jury vote is. And so jury nullification can cause an acquittal. It can cause a mistrial or a hung jury, as you'd say. Now, most cases, juries do reach a verdict in the end. I think what happens is that the jurors tend to, you know, once it starts going in one direction, they start following it. And if there are some determined people that are not going to find somebody guilty, the holdouts, you know, one by one kind of end up coming to a not guilty verdict. So it only takes one person or a few. I mean, everyone maybe has seen the movie 12 Angry Men. You know, one guy can start it, what ends up in a flood of people to acquit. And but either way, very often when you have a hung jury where they can't reach a decision, the prosecutor will realize that maybe his case wasn't as good as he thought it was, or the local citizens are not as excited about his law as he was, and so he may become a little more rational about it and maybe make an offer that the defendant can't refuse or something like that, or just dismiss the charges if he realizes the folly of what he's doing. And that frequently happens. And of course, if there's an outright acquittal, it's just over. The defendant goes home and they don't bother him with that again.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the drug war is something that comes up a lot, obviously, with the Freedom Fiends and, you know, Guns and Weed and the Road to Freedom. This is a reoccurring topic or a reoccurring theme on the show here. And so I almost feel like this jury nullification stuff could be a very, very beneficial tool in keeping nonviolent, quote-unquote, criminals, you know, your person that gets caught with a certain vegetable in his pocket or or something. And this could really help keep those guys out of prison with hardened criminals, feeding the system, if you will, and coming out of these prison systems as a hardened criminal, almost.
You know, That may be a factor more in the future. I never saw it happening much when I was a prosecutor. Our jurors in my part of the country were pretty happy about convicting people of drug crimes, and of course we do not have jury nullification here in terms of it being legal for a defense attorney to tell the jury they have the right to judge both the law and the facts. But I think it was it last year? Who was the fellow charged with drug dealing, selling marijuana up in New Hampshire? Oh, Rich Paul was
Rich Paul, yeah.
And I think, if I remember right, that first of all, New Hampshire does have a statute that allows the defense attorney to tell the jury that they have the right to nullify and judge the law as well as the facts. Well, that does you no good if the jury is cool with the law. And it didn't do him any good.
Right.
So it has to be where the law is out of sync with the community standards. Now, what happens now if more and more states start legalizing marijuana, and the states that haven't legalized it, you get kind of people that are half and half? We could see this changing, and more people saying, I'm not gonna convict for that. And of course, you know, you get half of them say, I won't convict, and the other half are willing to, but they're going to start losing their conviction, and they're going to throw in the towel and say, I'll forget it, and they quit him. Or they hang the jury, and the prosecutor decides it isn't even worth coming back and trying the case again, even on a mistrial with a hung jury. So it's, you know, it could be more of a factor in the future than it has been in the past on that issue.
All right, and I think that's one of the reasons it's so good that there's people out there outside. I mean, we were speaking a little bit about Julian Hoechlin earlier today, and mm-hmm. how he actually goes out. I believe initially he was outside of courthouses handing out FIJA information and more information on jury nullification to potential jurors walking into the courtrooms. And I believe he was actually arrested for this and tried and wasn't able to get jury nullification, ironically.
I don't know if it was in federal court but most states do not allow you to tell the jury that they can nullify. I mean, there's very few places. I don't know. There may be more than New Hampshire. New Hampshire's the only one that I know of that allows you to do that. It's one thing to say that it's legal for the jury to do it. Totally different thing to tell the jury that they're allowed to do it. Okay. That's a terrible secret that the courts do not let out in most places. And with him... And I'm not completely familiar exactly with what the charges are, but I assume it's something along the lines of
tampering,
jury tampering. Sure. Yeah. Now that may be required that you have a specific case in mind, and they might not be able to prove it. But that's where we have it.
All right,
we'll be right back, huh?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. We'll wrap this jury nullification up on the other side here. We'll be right back, guys.
Listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Squisgar Squig Elves from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech as hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $5 for 10 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
I hear an echo.
Echo. Echo, that's no good.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, see, I love this music coming in and out. It always gets me all nice and pumped up. That's some excellent music from one of Michael's many bands that he's been making music with over the years. All of it good. So I guess, okay, this is the Freedom Fiends, the Funky Fox. I'm sorry, the Freedom Fox. See, I'm already screwing that up. Garrett Fox here with Randy England, the Wampus Cat.
And Wampus Cat, that's me.
And you brought up a really good point during the little commercial break there, and I'm glad you did, because there really is two sides to every coin. And there is a negative side to jury nullification, and I want to go ahead and pass that off to you and let you elaborate a little bit more on
You couldn't talk to anyone who is against jury nullification without them pointing out that, you know, what if this was back in the 60s during the civil rights movement and you had some defendant who's accused of murdering, say, a black person in the Deep South, and you had this racist jury, and if they could nullify, you know, they would nullify because they don't want to convict their racist buddy, you know, who did the thing. And obviously, you know, that's something that could happen, probably has happened at some point. Of course, it's not the 60s anymore. And I'm not sure what you could ever do about that situation, because anytime the local community gets too far out of sync with the law, you know, something's going to break. And, you know, jury nullification is almost, is kind of a safety valve, you know, with that sort of thing. Most of the time, I think jury nullification can be beneficial. I mean, back before the Civil War, you had American Civil War, it was Northern juries that refused to enforce, say, the Fugitive Slave Act. And that was something that moved the nation toward war and the abolition of slavery, because a Northern jury wasn't going to convict some guy who refused to send a slave back to his owner in Mississippi. And so, you know, it worked that way. And in times past, it has worked that way more often than it has in the wrong way. But there's some other things kind of built into the law that keep it from going the wrong way. You might ask, what if a jury doesn't like the defendant and just convicts him when he didn't actually break the law? I mean, right. That would be wrong. But that shouldn't be a problem, probably for a couple of reasons. You know, the courts, first of all, you can easily have a rule that says you're only going to instruct the jury about their right to judge the law, their right to nullify, if the defendant requests the instruction. That way you couldn't have the state using that against an unlovely defendant. So that's one thing you could do to keep it from going the wrong way. And also, different from an acquittal. If a defendant is acquitted, he cannot be retried. But if you are convicted on facts that clearly show that you're innocent, that's a completely different thing. You do have the right to appeal, and
right.
The Court of Appeals can set a conviction aside when it's clear that it was made for the wrong reason and that this was a manifest injustice. So you have another thing built in, whereas a defendant can be clearly guilty and still be acquitted. He cannot be clearly innocent and be convicted, because that's going to get tossed out by a higher court, or at least will in most situations. So that's kind of a thing that saves you. I think it would have 95% good effects, and that last 5% would be that racist jury in the Deep South.
Well, I'll tell you what, you certainly have given me, and I'm sure the listeners, plenty to think about on this, and I guess we'll just tie that up right there, and when we get back on the other side of this break, I really want to talk about this Kansas City Preventative Patrol experiment.
Worms.
All right, we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
This is the Central Scrutinizer.
I steal your labor by force through taxation.
My job is to spy on you and keep you from hearing things like the Freedom Fiends. I especially do not want you to
torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to keep them drone-proof. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives. Do not go to freedomfiends.com and click on the torrent link and learn how to torrent Fiends archives.
Yeah, all right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Freedom Fiends. Gary Fox here, joined by Randy England. We have some wrestling names, but we've spit that out enough tonight. Randy, you there with me, bud?
I am here.
I'll tell you what, man. I sure am enjoying our conversation tonight.
Me too. It's rather laid back, you know, except when we come back, you know, when the music, I mean, my toes still tapping, you know.
Yeah, so. There you go. A little head banging going on over there.
Well, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been reading up on this article you sent me earlier today. I'm a bit of an amateur scientist myself, so I love experimenting with stuff, especially experiments on like a big social level. And I think this is a really interesting one. I'm not sure how long ago this was, but If the listeners want to kind of play along at home, if you look up the Kansas City Prevention Patrol Experiment, you're going to get a really good little read up on this experiment they did with what it sounds like a preventative patrol experiment. And I guess they're referring to cops patrolling in certain neighborhoods. You care to give us the synopsis there, Randy?
Well, yeah, this is it's a really old story, and I never heard of it when I was a prosecutor, and of course it was way before, this is so long ago, it was probably before a lot of people were born, 1972.
Wow.
I was in college. I was, you know, just a kid myself when this thing happened. And there was a police chief in Kansas City who had been there for quite a long time. You know, I can't remember the guy's name yet, but he ended up being, I think, the head of the FBI or something later. But he was very well respected and did this thing, which was considered kind of gutsy, and that was ask the question, does it do any good to go out and patrol around in your car in the neighborhoods? Does that do anything?
Hitting the beat.
Well, does it do anything to combat crime or lower crime? Or does it even make people feel safer when you do it? And he wanted to know, and I guess he had a strong enough reputation and strong enough in his job that he said, we're just going to do it. We're going to do this, and hooked up with some outside people that helped put this experiment together. I guess it was a science experiment, and they were going to find out whether all of the patrols were doing any good at all. I don't believe that anyone has done a study like this since then. I mean, this is the one, the only. I think there's been some that kind of worked around on the edges of it and tested some other things, mainly some experiments to find out what they were going to do about the results of this experiment, which they did not like. And we can get into that, I guess, if you like what it was about.
Real quick, I do want to just kind of, personally for me, when I see a cop roll through my neighborhood, it does not make me feel safer by any means, because the first thing that clicks in my mind is, what is this cop doing here? Am I in a high crime area? Did something go down with one of my neighbors around here? Are they looking for somebody? It kind of invokes all of these different questions in my mind personally. I feel a lot safer when I don't see the cops around, because that, to me, just makes it seem like everything's kind of hunky-dory. Everybody's happy in their day-to-day routine. But yeah, just real quick, I want to the experiment here part is, I'm surprised to see that this went almost a year, it looks like. It began in October, like you were saying, of 1972. I was not even a glimmer in my parents' eye yet, but October of 1972 and continued through 1973, it was administered by the Kansas City Police Department and evaluated by the Police Foundation. And right. So that's kind of interesting right there, you know, the police evaluating themselves. And patrols were varied within 15 police beats. Routine preventative patrols, a patrol was eliminated in 5 beats, labeled reactive beats, meaning the officers entered these areas only in response to calls from the residents. Normal routine patrol was maintained in 5 control beats. And then in 5 proactive beats, patrol was intensified by 2 to 3 times the norm. So you had, I like how they had that set up. You kind of had like the 3 different ranges of all of that. And, you know, so I guess the whole point of it was, they're saying here, the experiment asked the following questions. Would citizen notice changes in the level of police patrol? Would different levels of visible police patrol affect recorded crime or the outcome of victim surveys? Would citizens' fear of crime and attendant behavior change as a result of the different patrol levels? And finally, would their degree of satisfaction with police change? And that's all really interesting to me, because, I mean, essentially, what came out of all of this?
Well, you know, the intuitive thing, and maybe what they were looking for, is that the answer to all those questions, I assume they thought the answer would be yes, that citizens would notice whether they had triple the police patrolling as opposed to none at all anymore. And would it affect the crime rates, either recorded, reported crimes, or people's surveys saying how much crime they thought there was? And what was the next one they said? Citizen fear of crime and attendant behavior change as a result of different patrol levels? Would their satisfaction with the police change? In every single question, nothing. No change at all. 3 times as many cops patrolling, no change. No cops patrolling, no change. There, one thing they don't have on that short list of the main outcome or questions in it. Another thing they checked of the crimes that they did, first of all, they limited it to a certain subset of crimes, the sort of crimes that could even be deterred by police being seen on the street, like burglaries of houses or break-ins of cars, and certain things like murder or domestic assault wouldn't have been included in that, because I think everybody was assumed and recognizes, and I guess I do too, that people don't assault their wives, you know, in front of other people, let alone in front of the police. So that's not, and it usually happens inside where no one can see it anyway. So they did kind of zero in on the kinds of crimes that could even conceivably be affected by police driving by. Mm-hmm. But one crime that I think surprised them also is not a crime, but that, you know, when you have no police patrolling your streets, that means everybody knows, well, there are no cops. I can roll through the stop sign, things like that. You know, guess what happened to the rate of accidents? No rates. Apparently, people, when there's not a cop behind them, still won't roll a stop sign when there's somebody else coming.
Imagine that. You pull up to an intersection in your vehicle, and you might think to stop and look. We were talking about this on Sunday's show during the day of Freedom Fiends, where Chandler had literally just gotten pulled over for, apparently he stopped I'm sorry, allegedly, I guess that's the term I have to use here. Allegedly, he did stop, and he still got pulled over, and the cop claimed that he rolled through the stop sign. And once again, it's one of those things where Chandler knew that he was safe to proceed ahead, regardless of whether or not he came to a complete stop or not. He was taking responsibility for himself and his passenger and anybody else on the road.
I've heard that defense in court 100 times.
Yeah.
Zero effect.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Nobody was coming when I ran that stop sign. Uh-huh. Your Honor, what more proof do we need? Please convict him his own mouth.
And it begs the question. You had mentioned this right in the beginning of the segment. Why haven't we seen more cases like this more recently than since the 70s? And I have a theory, and I believe it has something to do along with the fact that it seems to me that the police are really there to generate revenue for the state. So not only do taxpayers pay their salaries and everything, but they also are getting robbed by these bandits for once again, victimless crimes where nobody gets hurt and nothing bad happens. It's just a technicality in a law book somewhere that allows them to be charged. I believe he got fined well over $100 for this quote unquote infraction. So does that make sense to you? I wonder.
Yeah, you're not going to get out of town under $100. It can be a lot more than that. There's certainly that in many cases, like particularly municipal courts and that, are kind of a money machine. And, they almost exist for that purpose. But whether it's municipal court or in the state courts or whatever, of course, whether anyone was endangered by your conduct is a complete irrelevancy. Now, yeah, if somebody was endangered by your conduct, they might throw on some additional charges. But they say, hey, Judge, all I said was he's running a stop sign. I didn't say he hurt anybody. And that's all there is to it. I mean, that's the only question. And if it was a jury trial, which it probably wouldn't be, that's all they'd have to prove.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Randy. I mean, that's why anytime I go out on that road, I keep in mind, all right, my taillights are good to go. My license plate, my license plate has its own papers. You got to make sure your stickers are up to date. Don't give them any reason to pull you over, because that can not only royally screw up your day or evening, it can royally screw up the rest of your life, depending on what's going on.
Do the wrong thing, maybe it'll end up getting you hurt or something. Who knows? Well, the results of this study, when I read them, I was thinking, boy, they sure don't like this. I mean, how are the police going to parse this? How are they going to spin it? And they did spin it. It's not like we can just cut back on the police now. Not going to happen.
Well, I'll tell you what, Randy, when we come back, I want to switch it up a little bit. I want to talk about something more fun. Oh.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
no cats were harmed during the commercial break. Welcome back to the Freedom Fiends. This is the Freedom Fox, Gary Fox, joined by Randy England, the Wampus Cat. Welcome back to the show here, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't know how much of that you guys caught before we went into the bumper music there, but I feel like we can kind of nip that thing in the butt there, and we can have some fun for these next few segments here. It occurred to me when we were discussing a little while ago that you're not entirely familiar with these 3D printing devices, huh, Randy?
I have never even seen one except in a video.
Okay.
But I'm intensely interested. Well, I want one.
I was very, very fortunate enough a couple of years ago to have stumbled across this this project. It's based around a 3D printer that can reproduce itself. Oh, I know that sounds scary to some people. The project is known as RipRap, and if anybody wants to check it out, if you head to riprap.org, there's a good wiki page with all sorts of resources and information on this. So anything that we don't cover here today, you should be able to get your questions answered there. But essentially, what me and a buddy of mine, we discovered this device, this desktop printer that has the ability to reproduce its own parts. Now, it's not every single component. There's obviously some electronics that are involved in here. There's some wiring. There's some stepper motors. There's a couple of different drivers. There's an extruder. That's the extruder. You can almost think of it works very, very similar to a hot glue gun. I mean, everybody's used a hot glue gun in you know, some kind of craft or whatever. But essentially, you have the rod that goes into the back of this heating element, and then when you pull your trigger, it squeezes out a little bit of melted glue, right? And so a 3D printer basically works the exact same way, except it's connected to a device that not only as a regular two-dimensional desktop printer does, goes back and forth and up and down to print on paper. Well, for the most part, it goes, you know, across the page and then moves down the page a little bit and then goes across the page again. These actually work on the third axis or the third dimension, which is, you know, the Z or the Z axis. So it'll move up and down, creating different planes. So essentially what you get is different layers building on top of different layers of extruded plastic. And the possibilities, what these things can print is quite limitless. I don't know. Randy, have you heard of the... now I can't remember the name of the single shot gun. There was a 3D printed gun that the guy Cody Wilson had designed.
Cody Wilson's gun?
Yeah. And I haven't had the chance yet to experiment with that or not. I know the model, the code and everything was put online at one point in time, but it quickly got regulated, and I believe he was ordered to take it all down. But, you know, once it got out there, it was out there.
And not before everybody got to see it work on YouTube.
Right. Now, for the longest time, these printers have been very, very expensive and hard to attain unless you have some sort of business with a lot of backing. It was very hard for the average consumer or prosumer or just, you know, average hobbyist to get a hold of this stuff. So me and my buddy, we pulled some funds together and we ordered one of these kits. And so the kit came with these plastic parts that had been created by another 3D printer. And then we had to go and buy the electronics and the different rods. And I've got a manual the size of a textbook that shows you how to put this thing together. And, you know, we spent a good week putting this thing together and getting everything wired up. And so
are you saying that is this the RepRap printer that you talked about?
Yep.
Yep. Is that the and you ordered one of those and only the plastic parts came?
That's right.
So, but it told you what metal and electronic parts to go out and buy.
Yes, they had a very detailed materials list or a bill of materials and actually sources to where you could find all that stuff. But
so I guess what you could do is go out and buy double hardware, build one and make this plastic for the second one.
Absolutely.
Have you done it?
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's get into this a little bit more on the other side of the market
All
here.
All right. I want one more now.
All right.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Hi, hello, and welcome back, everybody. Freedom Fiends Live. Garrett Fox here with Randy England. And
the Wampus Cat.
Yeah.
You forgot that.
The Freedom Fox and the Wampus Cat. Back at it again.
We're here. Still here.
So we've been talking a little bit here about the rep wrap and kind of 3D printing in general. And you had a couple of good questions there for me during the break, and one of them was how much does one of these things cost? And
yeah,
And that to me is part of the beauty of this particular project. See, you can go online right now, shell out anywhere from $1,200 to $3,000 for one of these plug and play type 3D printers, where you order the thing, it shows up, and you plug the thing into your computer, install some software, and you're ready to go. Now, don't get me wrong. If you can swing that's a good way to go about it. For other people who don't have such a disposable income, this is really the way to go about doing it, because like we were talking about, you order one of these parts kits, and then you got to source out all the other little metals parts, and you got to get all your hardware and your motors and your circuit boards and everything.
But they give you a list, right?
Absolutely. Okay. And depending on the level of detail that you want to get into, that bill of materials can double and quadruple. It really depends on what you want to get out of your 3D printer. Like, let me put it to you this way. I've got right now on my microphone stand, I have those little clips that kind of hold the wires over to your stand so they're not dangling around and all that stuff, so your kitty can't knock them around and mess with them.
Well, on your stand, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I broke one of those not too long ago, and I went up to my buddy and I said, hey, man, he had a 3D printer at the time, and I said, hey, man, I broke this thing. I was going to try and glue it back together, but I wanted to see if you could 3D print me another one. And sure enough, he busted out a micrometer, took a couple measurements, and within a half hour, I had six clips printed out for me.
Did he have a software template already made for a clip like that?
Nope. He took the measurements and dimensions that he came up with off of the thing and put it into a 3D model on his computer. And then you take that 3D model that you design on your computer using practically any software that you want, and you export it to what's called G-code. And G-code is what the machine itself reads, and that's what tells the printer what to do. Where to go and how much plastic to extrude, and when to step up a level and do the next layer, and so on and so forth. And now this is a really, really simple thing. It kind of looks like a teardrop with two different holes in it. And they work great. They're stronger than the ones that came with my microphone stand. They're more flexible and a lot more resistant to breaking. And I didn't have to go online and order another one of these. So that's just a small example of how beneficial these things can be. And like you were alluding to during the last segment, you could almost order, or, you know, when you're going through and you're sourcing all these parts, you could get the parts that you need to build one printer. And then after you get that up and running, print out another set of parts and basically have another 3D printer ready to go. That's essentially what I'm doing right now. Is I'm putting together my second rep wrap. You seemed pretty happy for me that I have it sitting behind me right now. I could reach back here and touch it if I wanted to look away from the microphone for a moment. And I've actually, believe it or not, I've sat there and just stared at this thing and enjoyed its company. It's almost like having a little. It's like having a piece of family. It's like another pet sitting there, and I can make anything that I want. And so I guess what I was getting to earlier is, you, like I said, you can buy these things pre-assembled, and if you can't afford to do it, this is a great program to get into. When I ordered these parts, I actually got essentially a family tree. And it showed the very first rip wrap that was ever made was at the top. And one might wonder, how did the first rip wrap come to be if there wasn't another rip wrap to print out these parts? They used an old fashioned technique known as injection molding. I'm not sure if you're familiar with what injection molding is, but it's basically when it's kind of like how Legos are made, where you have a mold and it just blasts a whole bunch of melted plastic into that mold and lets it cure for a split second, and then it spits it out, and you've got you've got your little plastic component there.
Which is cheap if you want to make a bunch of them, but super expensive if you only need a few.
And if you don't have a factory to hold all of this equipment, exactly. It can become pretty tricky. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, which is this what we're referring to now with 3D printing is called additive manufacturing. There's also subtractive manufacturing, I believe is what it's called. I might be messing up that term right there, but that's basically like your CNC machines, where you have a lathe or basically like a self-contained bin that it removes metal or plastic from. Is it kind of like whittling with wood, like what you
like a router or something?
Absolutely. You're removing material away from something, which can be very, very wasteful. So this essentially is reducing the amount of waste that you use. You know, when you print something out, you might have to sand it down a little bit or drill out a hole if you need to, but you're essentially conserving as much of your raw material as possible.
Can I back you up before you get too far away from something that fascinated
me? Please, get me back on track here.
The family tree, did your printer come with a genealogy?
Yep.
Like, is your printer like the great-great-granddaughter of the first printer couple, or what?
Well, like I was getting to, the very first printer was made from this injection molding technique. They put together a machine, they printed out another one, and that machine essentially produced hundreds of these plastic parts. And then I believe there was one more printer that was made off of those parts, and that is the printer that made the parts that I received in the mail.
You know, this is, I mean, with all of these printers relating to one another, I mean, it's kind of a tribe. I mean, I'm starting to get sort of a Skynet feel here.
Yeah, if I ever wake up in the middle of the night and this thing's just going at it, I'll be sure to dismantle it there.
If you wake up and you find it making a 3D gun is what you need to worry about.
Well, luckily, you can always unplug the thing.
Well, let me ask you a couple other questions. Sure. You said you were talking about these printers in general at the beginning. Is this one that uses heated plastic to go through its extruder?
Yep. Yeah, the extruder itself is what heats up the plastic. So you can use there's PLA plastic and... of course, I can't think of the acronym for the other one.
MLA. Does it come in a stick or a roll?
It's like a coil. It kind of looks like just wrapped up wire, but it's
feeds
just
in like filament. Solder.
Correct.
Like a roll of solder.
Or like on your welding machine, how you have the wire coming through the gun itself. Okay. Before you connected to. I think it's not an arc welder, but...
Or like the stick in a hot melt glue gun.
Bingo.
Yeah, which everybody knows, right? I know what that is.
Yeah. And on that note, real quick, since you're talking about the filament, a lot of people have been concerned about the cost of this filament. ABS plastic, that's the one I was looking for. There is another machine, Randy, that you can make that's called the RecycleBot. And you can make a RecycleBot off of your printed components from a 3D printer. And what this allows you to do is take your ordinary run-of-the-mill gallon milk jug. You cut it up into sheets and then run it through an ordinary everyday office shredder, something that you want to destroy some documents, you run it through a shredder. That turns all of these, all these plastic jugs into little, strands of plastic, which you can put inside of this RecycleBot, and it will extrude a whole new set of filament for you. So,
that's a little different than having to buy your inkjet ink or your laser powder from Epson or Canon or something like that.
Yep. Yeah, and so, any of these extra parts that you print out that you wind up not needing, you can chop them up and send them through the RecycleBot again. And it really minimizes the amount of waste that you're using out of your little home your little home manufacturing plant. It's a desktop revolution, if you will.
That's kind of neat. That way you can play around and have a lot of failures and it won't matter.
Right. And like you were kind of saying during the break, if you break a component on your printer, you can always... people are constantly improving the parts of their own printer. So that's why a lot of times these guys do like what you were saying, and they have two of these operational at any one time, and they're constantly improving on these things. And there's a very, very active community online, which you can find once again through riprap.org. There's forums where people are very, very helpful and very, very friendly, basically working together with each other to make these things work. Say you do break, you only have one printer and you break a part, you can go online and tell somebody, hey, I need this, this left, right foot or my extruder broke, help guys. And these guys are so excited to help out. They'll just, what's your address? Here, I'll send it to you right now. Or I'll print you one overnight and I'll ship it out to you in the morning.
So, paper printers, they're gauged in dots per inch. Does this work that way? Does it, I mean, what is its, what's the word for looking for? Resolution.
Okay. And it's interesting you bring that up. I don't actually have the units in front of me, but that all depends on your extruder head. That's really the core of these machines.
Does it make a real smooth surface?
If you want it to.
It's not real bumpy like it would be if it had a low resolution.
You could run your finger over it and feel the grooves and feel the different layers, but that's kind of part of the fun. If you want to make it a little bit smoother and softer, you can do that. It's whatever you're, you know, you just really got to think about it and be an engineer. We'll wrap this up here on the other end.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've been on the World Wide Web since its inception in 1994. I've tried dozens of web providers in that time. The only one that hasn't broken my heart is HostGator. HostGator has unlimited server space, unlimited throughput, and a guaranteed uptime of better than 99.9% for only $150 a year. You can pay a little less elsewhere, but you'll pull out your hair dealing with anyone else. HostGator has great service and unlimited tech support, only a phone call away, 24/7, 365. HostGator is where pros like the Fiends host, because we know how to do it right. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the HostGator affiliate link on the right sidebar to sign up today.
The final segment of the Freedom Fiends. Always a sad segment. I almost hate to say goodbye. So this is Garrett Fox here with Randy England, and it seems I've gotten you pretty excited about this, huh, Randy?
I'm pretty going about this rep printer. I want one. I've been able to look the other way, you know, when they cost $1,500 or something and more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm getting pretty worked up about this.
Well, and you said you're a bit of a hobbyist, a tinkerer.
I just like computers. I got my first one in 1982, and yeah, kept several humming, you know, all the time since then. Well, back in the 80s, you had to build your own, and there was nobody anywhere to help.
That's definitely a good skill to have when it comes to this stuff. If you know how to work a soldering iron, you'll be in good shape.
Well, no, it wasn't that bad back in the 80s. The board's plugged in and out and everything, but okay. You just, you know, if you had to put in a new hard drive and things like that, you didn't just stick it in and have the machine go, "Oh, I see I have a new hard drive."
Well, I guess that's maybe something I should iterate here. You kind of have to be handy with electronics and even mechanical parts and everything. You know, I used to be an auto mechanic. That's how I got myself through college and everything. So I've always been good with my hands. And you really need to be a tinkerer in order to take this thing on. Otherwise, now
you're just throwing down the gauntlet to me. But you know, this stuff is really important. I mean, I don't know. You know, you have one. You see where it's going in that. Did you see the article the other day that the first 3D printer is going up to the International Space Station?
Yes,
in August.
Yes, thanks to SpaceX. Yep.
Yeah, it's going up on a private carrier. Even how cool is that? But when these things get going, I mean, don't you think they'll get rid of all that excess inventory and every ship at sea and like submarines? Mm-hmm. Aircraft carriers, how could they not have a stack of these things in there? And this kind of does what the internet did, you know, a few years ago. Anybody that really wanted to be in touch and clued into things almost needed to always be in a big city. Mm-hmm. Like back in the 80s when I was, you know, got my first computer, if I hadn't been, I was in Kansas City at the time, and it was big enough to have a user group where I could go and learn about stuff from other people. But and if you didn't live in a town at least that big, you're just out of luck and you had no help at all. It was just horrible. But the internet changed all that. You can be out in the middle of nowhere and you're still there. And this thing kind of has that vibe to it. You don't have to be, you know, near a factory and that sort of thing. You can be sitting on a mountaintop making all your parts or at the bottom of the ocean.
Imagine if the guys on Apollo 13 had one of these three 3D printers at their disposal, they would have easily been able to create this whatever it was they needed, something to clear out the carbon from the air. I forget exactly what happened up there, but they could have essentially printed out the components that they needed.
CO2 scrubbers, you're right. Talking about, and of course the big thing here is that you can make anything you want without a license from the government.
Oh, wow. There you go. Now you're talking.
There's the whole thing is just revolutionary. It builds on itself. I mean, throw the internet together, throw this thing with the internet, throw Bitcoin into that and everything. Mm-hmm. If I had some of the government stock, I'd be selling it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a sinking ship, and I don't think they know how to work these this technology just quite yet. I don't even know if they've figured out how to work their own websites at this point.
They're always too far behind the curve to kill these things that are going to kill them in the end.
Yeah.
And I just love that. They're not geeky enough. I mean, I'm sure there's geeks that work for the government, but probably nobody listens to them.
Yeah, well, not until it's too late anyhow. Tell you what, Randy, it's certainly been a pleasure, man.
Hey, me too. Hey, I'm going to be back next Sunday.
Excellent.
So I'll see you then.
Looking forward to doing this with you again.
Worms.
All right, that's just the Freedom Fox. I'm out of here. Randy, you have a good one.
Good night.